brought to you by the Magnolia Firm. Building a business is a massive accomplishment, and selling it is one of the biggest decisions of your life. When it comes time to get acquired, you deserve the highest possible value and the best fit buyer. Unfortunately, most brokers out there have zero technical knowledge or experience owning companies of their own, let alone a digital business. That's where the Magnolia Firm comes in. They're an M&A firm specializing in helping digital businesses get acquired. Their team is made up of former digital entrepreneurs just like you, so they know what it's like to be in your shoes. To get a free 15-minute valuation and tips to maximize your exit, visit the link down below in the description. Now let's get on with the show.
Computer. Welcome to the Top M&A Entrepreneurs. Today, my guest is Adrian Pinto. Adrian spent some time, some years at a private equity firm, and then he bought a landscaping business in Georgia, Atlanta, Georgia.
Yes.
Yeah. 1 year later, how's it going?
It's going, you know, it's going well. I mean, it's been a very busy year, lots of learning, you know, lots of, I think a lot of situations where, you know, I probably did a good job kind of expecting what would occur. And then a lot of instances where I probably didn't. And so it's, you know, a lot of reflection kind of over the last month or so too, you know, just kind of thinking back on that whole year. So it's been good though.
Yeah. So good as a learning experience or good as you help the business get more profitable or grow?
Both, which I think is a good thing. You know, I guess to your first point, I mean, it's definitely, you know, a learning experience. I mean, so you kind of alluded to it a little bit. So my background historically was in, I started in investment banking doing M&A at Credit Suisse in New York. And then I worked at two different private equity firms over 4 years, focusing predominantly on industrial and industrial services companies. First was doing kind of traditional leverage buyouts. And then second was more kind of growth investments. But in all of those instances, you know, we had exposure to management teams, but we obviously did not do that ourselves. We weren't operating partners, you know, we were on the investment team. And so you're kind of looking at things with a bit of a different lens. And so, you know, you juxtapose that now with kind of what this role looks like. And obviously it's very different, right? It's kind of the, on some ways, the polar opposite. And so I think that, you know, as you were asking about the kind of the learning experience, I mean, there's been a ton of that just in terms of how do you, you know, work with and kind of, you know, lead in this position, a team of people like this and kind of tackling an entirely new industry, you know, lots of kind of learning experiences throughout the, you know, the year there. On your second point, yeah, I mean, the business has done really well. I mean, frankly, I got fortunate to buy at a time when we were already kind of experiencing some good growth. So the themes were pretty strong as I came in on board, but then, you know, our first year, we ended up growing probably somewhere between 30 and 40%. And so, you know, from a top line perspective, it's been, you know, terrific. And I think a lot of the initiatives that we've undertaken on the business development front, which has been kind of my priority, have been really fruitful. You know, the pipeline for over the next kind of 12 months looks as strong as ever. So, you know, really exciting stuff there.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Let me go back to your PE world about what your assignment or role was. You know, they, like, hey, go do diligence or go run the numbers. What were you doing for the private equity firms?
Yeah. So typically the way it would work is, you know, especially at the first PE firm that I worked for, they would, you know, a lot of the deals that they did were bank sourced. So the banks would come to them. They did some proprietary stuff that, you know, through contacts or whatever, you know, they got kind of a relationship based sourcing. But for the most part, you know, banks would come to them and they'd say, hey, we're marketing this company, you know, company XYZ. Are you guys interested? So the partner would get that through his relationship with one of the major banks. They would kick it to an associate like myself and they'd say, hey, you know, can you get the NDA? First of all, you know, complete the NDA on behalf of the firm, but then take a look at the materials and let me know if it's interesting. So we would kind of do an initial review based off of some things that we knew the firm liked, that partner liked, you know, whether that's certain metrics, you know, return on invested capital or, you know, different things around margins and profitability. And if we felt like it kind of made some sense, we would then kind of recommend it to the partner. I mean, certainly there were times where the partner would kind of say to you, hey, I like this. I don't really care if you like it. You know, we're going to spend some time here. But a lot of times they really would kind of lean on the associate's opinion. mainly just as like a filtering tool. And then from there, you know, it was the associate's job to kind of do the initial kind of financial analysis on the business. So looking at financials, trying to come up with a pretty high level firm case from an underwriting perspective, and what would the returns look like in that case? And so, you know, you might spend a little bit of time and find out, well, the margins aren't very strong and there's pretty high capital intensity. So, you know, at a very modest level of growth, like this would only return, you know, blank multiple of invested capital. And so in an instance like that, you'd kind of report the findings and the partner might say, eh, it's not really that interesting. Or, you know, you'd spend a little bit of time and say, yeah, this actually does kind of check some of our boxes. Like it's probably worth spending some more time. And then at that point, you would either kind of speak with some form of industry resource that the firm already had, like an operating partner who maybe knew the space, or you would hire a expert network, like a GLG resource, who might give you some insight into the market more broadly. So that way you can kind of get a more holistic picture. And so the whole time that's going on, you know, the associate is kind of the, I would say, the numbers person or the data person behind a lot of that. And then as you kind of progress in the purchasing process, so, you know, first round, second round, final round, the associate kind of continues on in that role. So we would be responsible for building the, you know, the model, a lot of the financial diligence, helping kind of, I would say, liaison between the firm and a lot of our third party advisors as well.
Yeah. When did you make the decision, say, hey, I'm going to stop the private equity firm business and go buy my own? I mean, what kind of data points started adding up? Was it, you know, some people say, geez, I want to get married. I want to see my kid play soccer. I didn't want to work 100-hour weeks for a private equity firm for somebody else.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't really any of that. I mean, certainly I had a similar view that like long-term, I didn't see myself working that much because I was working a lot, obviously. I think for me, the bigger thing was like, the firm that I was at, we did a lot of buy and builds, right? Where we would buy a platform and then grow it through M&A. When doing that,
that was your last firm?
That was the first firm that I worked for.
First, okay. Yeah.
And so when doing that, you get exposure to a lot of smaller businesses. I also just happened to have exposure to a platform. So one of our kind of major investments, which was one of my portfolio companies, and that was a business that had grown basically as a result entirely of these kind of small acquisitions. So that business started as, you know, one kind of small business in Connecticut. The founders, two founder and best friends, did some of the M&A themselves. They grew it kind of into a bigger platform. Ultimately, we invested into it and then continued to go with that roll-up strategy. But in learning more and more about that business, what I came to, you know, find out was kind of the process that these guys went through early on in their careers to find that business, to grow it, you know, all this kind of what they undertook basically for during this process. And they had similar backgrounds to me. I mean, one of them was a finance guy. One of them was more of an operating guy, but they were just two friends that kind of had this idea of like, let's go find a business and, you know, do this kind of thing ourselves. You know, let's leave the corporate world. And so working with those guys quite closely, because it was one of my investments, you know, hearing about their story and all, you know, kind of throughout my time at that firm, was always just very interesting, of something that I was very attracted to. And, as I kind of was coming to the tail end of my associate years there, and thinking about, you know, do I want to try to stay on there and kind of stay in the investment seat? What do I want to do instead? You know, that kind of idea was always kind of nagging at the back of me, which is like, you know, why not try to do what these two guys did? You know, this was something that was really successful. And so anyway, that's where kind of the initial idea came from.
You mentioned that in a Twitter post, November 18, 2021, you talked about former CEO of one of your past portfolio companies, took an SMB, bolted on 7 acquisitions, created leader industry and $300 million revenue. That's the one you're referring to, or?
Yeah, I think it is, even though that.
Or I just mean, this one case. I mean,
I'm not sure, to be honest. Like, there was a couple instances of this. That may be the one. Although the business that I'm referring to is actually quite a bit bigger than that now, of which through M&A.
Yeah, this was a year ago. Yeah.
Even a year ago, the one I'm referencing is actually quite a bit bigger. But they, you know, they were just incredibly successful at that strategy, basically. And again, like for me, it was the combination of seeing the strategy, but also knowing the people and like their backgrounds. And that's, I think, why it seemed so relatable to me. Like I said, two friends, one of which was a finance guy. And I was like, oh, like, you know, it wasn't like some bunch of ex-CEOs that decided to go out and do this, right? It was just like a couple younger guys at a business school that had this you know, this plan. And so, you know, that's, I think, why it became so relatable.
Did you want to do this by yourself or did you have a partner?
I never really considered having a partner, but I mean, it's certainly something that I see the value in. You know, my kind of close friends and people that I share kind of professional interests with, you know, they all kind of do have their own thing going on. And so it was not like a natural situation. Certainly a lot of those same people are like, continue to be, you know, resources for me today to kind of spitball
ideas. Well, some people work better with a partner and some people are better running it by themselves.
I mean, I think if there was a natural, like, hey, this person also wants to move out of New York and they also want to move to Atlanta and they also are interested in this, then like I maybe would have shifted my opinion on that. But it just, because of all of those factors, it just, you know, didn't naturally kind of fit.
Yeah. So you were in New York and you hired somebody to do a buy side search for you, right?
I did, not initially. So I initially kind of undertook that myself. And then basically what happened was after a period of maybe 6-ish months of kind of limited success in terms of finding opportunities that were actionable, that's when I ultimately was like, you know, what else could I do here to kind of improve my pipeline? I was doing it part-time while I was working at this, you know, the second firm that I worked for.
Yeah.
And so I had the luxury of kind of having, additional time on my, it wasn't something where I needed this to happen in 6 months or 12 months, or like, you know, I was in a tough situation. Like I fortunately had, you know, income going, you know, coming in, which enabled me to kind of look over a little bit longer period of time. But that said, like, I didn't want this to take 3 years. And so after about 6 months of kind of limited success is when, I had gotten connected with a gentleman who lived in Atlanta, and his whole pitch was essentially like, you know, been here his whole life, knows a bunch of, you know, people in this market and business owners. And, he, you know, could introduce me to essentially two people prior to them kind of coming on market.
Yeah. And was it an on-market deal through a broker side investment banker? Was it off-market?
It was soon to be on market. And so it was essentially kind of like an early look.
Yeah. And you know, you got the SIM or you got the financials and you ran through the due diligence and you said, this meets the kind of criteria I'm looking for. I mean, how big was it? Were we talking about? I mean, 2 to 5 million or 2 to 10 million, somewhere in that range?
Yeah, the former. On the higher end of that range, but in the former, I mean, sort of, I mean, I think the way I approach it was like, you know, initial screening more on the market than anything else, 'cause I didn't know a ton about the market. And then I learned like, hey, the market actually checks a lot of these same theme boxes that I was hoping for. You know, we're gonna, like, this seems like it's worth kind of spending more time. And then it just kind of, you know, snowballed from there, basically. Like, then I had, you know, the first discussion with the prior owner, and that, you know, was positive, and learned a little bit more, and that was positive. And then just, like I said, just kind of continued to check a lot of boxes and produce kind of positive diligence results.
So why did he want to sell?
He had another business, wanted to focus on that, been doing it for a long time. And I think, you know, just wanted kind of a change.
Was that a bigger business or was he just stretched? No, it was a smaller business.
Yeah.
And it had more potential upside than this did, or did he?
I don't know how he would answer that question. I mean, I think the factor of doing it for 25 years, you know, whatever that's, 22 years. Like, I think that was a huge, huge driver of it.
Yeah.
You know, just like ready for kind of a something, you know, a change.
How old was he? 60, 50?
The latter.
Yeah. Yeah. And when did you decide you did the due diligence on the business, the financials look clean? Did you do your own audit or did you have somebody else look at it?
Did my own. Yeah. I think, you know, part of it was like that. I think that component of the diligence wasn't overly complex. I have a couple of friends that are accountants that kind of, you know, shed some eyes on, you know, they kind of looked at a couple of things on, you know, with me, but in general, that to me wasn't like one of the bigger, you know, kind of diligence items.
Yeah. So you had an early look under the hood. Was he asking a rational amount of valuation for the business?
He was.
Knew like, hey, this landscaping businesses are selling at 2x EBITDA or whatever that is.
Yeah. Essentially. I think the other thing is like, when I was earlier on in this process, well, you know, before the buy side broker, the first business that I had looked at seriously and submitted an LOI for, you know, I think I got pretty cute with how I handled the valuation of it. You know, I kind of took this like PE approach of like, well, you got a pro forma for this and adjust for that. And, you know, next thing you know, the resulting valuation is this. And it's like trying to present that to, you know, an owner of a business is like very challenging. As like
too much, huh?
Because they kind of were like, what are you talking about? Like, no, you know what I mean? Like, I think in general, a lot of the, you know, a lot of owners, and I've continued to see this when we've looked at add-on opportunities, it's like they have a number in their mind. And unless 15 offers come in well below that number, like they're probably not budging off of it. And they, you know, that's a number that they're kind of, they've circled. And so in that first example, you know, I clearly was just taking this approach, which was just like, didn't make sense for the situation. And so when I kind of had told myself, like, if I get into this situation again, and I like the macro themes, and I think that it checks a lot of these boxes, and, you know, the diligence seems, moderate, basically, I'm not going to get like overly cute with how I approach valuation, right? Like, ultimately, I think it's a binary outcome. Either you got it right on the macro, or you didn't. But, you know, a couple hundred grand either direction is not going to change, you know, the outcome over the course of a 10-year SBA loan. You know, I'm sure I could have taken a similar, like, ooh, adjust this, pro forma that approach to valuation. But I kind of said this next time, like, that feels reasonable. This can support that on a debt service coverage, you know, ratio standpoint.
And 10-year loan, it's got to 6% or something. Yeah.
Right. So I was like, it can handle all of this. And so, sure, I will do that. I will do that price.
He made it on, this is what I want to sell it for. Did the broker influence him to do that? Or was a buy side broker?
I mean, he had his own. Mine did not get involved in the discussion really at all. I think the only thing that was maybe debated around that was the handling of working capital. And that's because I came from a PE approach where like there is no such thing as keeping working capital, right? Like you set a peg. And then that, you know, that changes, like basically a business is left with a appropriate amount of working capital in the PE space. Right. And so that's kind of what I was expecting.
He wants to take the working capital.
Yeah. There was a lot of AR in the business. And that was the only kind of sticking point, I think. And so we kind of came to a bit of a middle ground on that, I would say. But as it related just purely to kind of purchase price.
What's the middle ground? He wants to say, let's say there's $500,000 in for a year's worth of working capital.
Yeah. I mean, basically like collectible AR was I forget exactly the terms that we use, but I mean, essentially he kept the majority of it, but anything that had additional costs required to still service because of how certain things were booked, like some things might've been booked already, but Nest weren't technically completely, you know, satisfied from a expense perspective, like that was all, you know, net. Like I wasn't stuck with those costs.
It's AR. We haven't completed the project and there's going to be cost to that project.
Right.
I'm not going to borrow extra to do that. The business should be paying for that.
Right. So in those situations, like that was all agreed to and appropriately handled. And there was really no, you know, we didn't really have any contention around that. But
was there anybody else trying to bid on the business or were you?
I think I had heard that there was one other one. I think I got a bit fortunate. It just at the time of when I signed my LOI, to even when I closed, but like, you know, last year was a crazy year, valuations across the board, right? In all kind of financial markets were going kind of gangbusters. I was fortunate that the LOI was initially signed in like February. And so it was, I think we kind of missed, I was kind of ahead of some of that from a timing perspective.
Well, the valuations went down, but the interest rate went up.
Well, I think this year, yeah, certainly. But last year, that wasn't the case, right? And so we signed in February of 2021. And so by the time we closed in July of 2021, I think the general market was quite a bit more highly valued than it was 6 months prior. And so I think in that regards, like, you know, it was a pretty a fair situation for me.
Yeah. Did you... always intend to use SBA money to finance a business? Or did you think about, look, how can we get into this a little bit faster? SBA is a 3 to 6 month process. I mean, use like February, March, April, May, June. That's, you know.
Yeah, I mean, ownership percentage was very important to me. So I kind of, once I figured out that that was a thing, the SBA note was a thing, like a thing that existed. It was pretty clear immediately that that's something I wanted to do. I think that it's a double-edged sword. You know, you talk about like the speed at transaction, which I think is a fair point and a hindrance. Mine ended up being okay. I think the bigger issue, in my opinion, with the SBA is the impact that it has on future growth opportunities. I mean, you know, when you do an asset sale and you create this new entity that has no credit history and you're using that to purchase the business and you fund it with an SBA loan, you now have, you know, a large loan that has seniority on all, you know, all assets, right? They have a blanket lien on all assets. And so by doing that, you put yourself into a very difficult situation for future financeability, whether you're looking for a line of credit or you're looking for a vehicle, any of these things, right? Because other future lenders are looking at this and they're like, what do I have? Yeah,
they're all subordinate. There's just,
right.
There's,
yeah. Exactly. So that has been a separate issue that I, you know, did not appreciate during diligence or even at close. Was like, well, if we end up growing at the rates that we have grown, and you know, we've looked for more sophisticated financing options, like in the line of credit, or simply just like several vehicles, you know, that we're going to need to
add. Or bolt on or add on.
Yeah, I mean, that would be the even bigger example of it. Any one of those things, though, like you put yourself in a very difficult position there, where like, you know, there's not a whole lot that you can do, and if you can do it, it's going to be at atrocious interest rates. So I think that's where the SBA. It's tough, right? Like it does give you this amazing opportunity, but then it also kind of handicaps you from a growth perspective.
Yeah. Have you thought of any ways to remedy that aside from like, okay, refinance and pay off the SBA faster?
I have a couple ideas in my mind that, you know, I'm toying with. I mean, I think, well, in the near term, the only one that really will, you know, make the nearest term situation will be, it's looking like we'll be able to get our SBA lender to subordinate themselves on our AR, which would allow us to then take an LOC with the lender taking priority on the accounts receivable, which I now have gotten a couple of lenders with some interest in. All the last year, basically, though, that wasn't an option, which, you know, from a cash flow management perspective was frustrating at times during, you know, spikes in working capital. But I think we'll be able to kind of navigate out of that if this ends up working as I hope it does. You know, I think there are options to fund future M&A. I mean, you could do another SBA loan, you know, or you could just try to, you know, acquire enough so that the pro forma business is large enough to get traditional bank financing. You know, there's challenges obviously with all of that stuff. So,
yeah. Was that idea you got from being in the private equity where this guy grew to 300 million or billion you're talking about, what, when they talk about the chassis, were they talking about like a, accumulator role or a platform company or a holding company or a roll up?
You're saying like, what did he specifically mean by that term?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he was talking about like the platform, right? So, you know, having the proper systems in place at the platform level so that when you go out and you do these small add-ons or even a large add-on, but like when you do something, you can instantly implement kind of a certain system or set of systems so that, you know, you create a 30, 60, 90 day plan, whatever it may be. And you say, okay, you know, HR, we're going to, you know, implement them on this and their, you know, supply chain procurement, they're going to come onto our system here. And, you know, something where literally day one, you can kind of flip a switch and a lot of these things start kind of, you know, aggregating.
Yeah.
And they had done it really, really well. And it costs a lot of money to set some of that stuff up. And, you know, I'm sure at times in the beginning when they were a bit smaller and they had some of it, like it was probably kind of expensive to have, but I think they're a great example of like where you see the fruit of a lot of that later on if you're going to do, you know, that many.
Yeah. You're familiar with Mark Leonard over at Constellation Software. I mean, where he has, you know, he's probably acquired, I don't know, 500 plus businesses, $1 billion.
Yeah, I've heard of them. Yeah.
Yeah. And he just creates this, he's an accumulator where he shares operational excellence programs. Where you're talking about the HR, the accounting and the systems in place where the next acquisition comes in. There's product differentiation. They don't share the same customers like they'd be in a marine software and then maybe mining oil software, completely unrelated. but they share operational excellence programs. Like you were talking about that in that Twitter feeds, like the ERP system.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. Have you implemented that? Like, is this like a playbook? You said you're going to come in, I'm going to implement, or are you still getting your head around what's happening in the business year later?
Yeah, I would say somewhere between the two. I mean, there's absolutely things that we have implemented already. I think as it relates to M&A, I think the, we just were talking about, like the financing has definitely been a bottleneck there. Well, you know, there have been some opportunities thus far. We're getting a little bit more, I would say, kind of serious and aggressive at looking at a couple other ones. You know,
In Atlanta or outside, anywhere that's...
I think the goal would be here first.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't necessarily have to be like in Metro Atlanta. Like, in fact, I actually think there's a lot of value in looking outside of Atlanta because of the, you know, a lot of the growth in Atlanta is kind of the surrounding suburbs. But I don't know if you've spent much time in Atlanta, but like the process of
driving a couple times. I've only been
east to west of Atlanta is a nightmare. And so like, you might as well be in another city. So, you know, we're on the east side, you know, if you were to simply look on the west side, it's like you would drastically expand your opportunity set and you would cut down on travel time. I mean, there'd be a huge kind of synergies associated with drive time by doing that. So that, I think there's a lot of value in that. But like I said, we've kind of been, I would say, slowed by the financing side. And then the other thing is like, I think, you know, something that we've experienced this past 12 months is when you grow in your first year at a rate like that, specifically in certain segments that have a lot of, you know, employees.
30% you know, in a landscaping business was all employees. Like,
and it was a lot more. It was more than that. I think it was 42. And yeah, it was a lot of, you know, additional heads. I think what we experience is like, you need to make sure you are adjusting your policies and practices and procedures in line with that growth. And if you don't, you know, it's going to have an impact. And so, you know, I think we experienced kind of come springtime when we are getting a lot more employees and, you know, the weather was ramping up and there's a lot more work to do. All of a sudden, you know, there were certain, I think, policies and practices that we had, which were probably not cut out for the new amount of people, whether that was the onboarding of new hires or how we approached overtime or, you know, a few, you know, things like that. And so I think that there has been enough to do, or, you know, just because of the organic growth, there's been enough to do internally this year that has kind of taken the focus away from looking for M&A. I think my focus has been, let's try to get our, you know, kind of our in-house operations in as good of a position as we can be before we go try to tack on additional things. Because the worst thing I think you could do as a small business, or specifically in our position, would be to bite off too much before, you know, more than you can chew. And then all of a sudden you've added two other businesses and these internal policy problems are just kind of metastasizing into, you know, your additional add-ons, basically.
Yeah, that's a, like, there's always great books about that, you know, Wayne Huizenga is in the roll up and just it created havoc when you acquire three or four businesses in a month.
Yeah, I can only imagine. So, I mean, I think we're getting to a point now where I would feel much more comfortable, you know, doing that and kind of taking on that challenge. But yeah, certainly, you know, I think if you asked me day one, I would have said, oh, immediately, that's going to be an immediate focus. And then I think after 6 months in, I was like, I don't know, like there's plenty to, you know, to kind of work on here. So that's, I think that desire has kind of fluctuated throughout the year.
How did you grow 42%? I mean, it's, you know, coming from a PE firm, did it come from the owner saying, hey, y'all, you know, sometimes they create these, here's how you grow up 42% by doing this and this. They didn't do it. They just said you should be doing it. Yeah.
And I mean, I would be obviously, I would be lying if I said like that was all driven because of me, right? Like it was just a combination of good things. I think it was a great macro backdrop. It was, you know, share of wallet expansion with existing customers. It was new customer growth, which I think was something that, you know, like, was something we've kind of really kicked off since, you know, I've been here.
I said probably COVID, there's a contraction and then 2021 come around and then 2022, it just said, hey, you know, we have some more money to spend.
Yeah, certainly on the, like our work that's tied to new housing starts, you know, where we kind of will install landscaping in new neighborhoods being developed. I think there was obviously good kind of macro backward tailwinds there. yeah, I think ultimately it was just a combination of like several factors that have kind of all happened at the same time, which is great. And I mean, you know, I think it, and more so than anything else, it just enabled us to, I would say, kind of start doing things sooner than we probably otherwise would have, you know, in terms of whether it's hires or, you know, looking at M&A or, you know, whatever that may be. Like, you know, we, a lot of that wouldn't have been possible if it was not for kind of this, you know, the environment in which I kind of closed.
Let me ask you about the multiple. I'm going back to this and the seller. I work with an SBA lender that, you know, wants to see history of the business. And that could be in 3 years average of EBITDA. And so he throws out 2020 because that's COVID. I mean, I put a business in front of the other day and yeah, they lost money in 2020. 2021, it was barely less than $100,000. And he goes, look, this is just doesn't have enough history. I mean, you could offer them one or two times, but we just don't have enough history to lend on it.
Yeah.
How did he do coming from COVID, I guess, rebounding?
He was, I mean, I think the business was down 4% during COVID. So hardly any impact. I mean, that's like the beauty of landscaping.
Was that reflected in the multiple though? Or did he just say, hey, it's 25-year-old company and I'm going to sell it at.
I mean, if you look at, you know, I think it was like a 6-year run of revenue. I mean, it was like a 5% annualized growth, over like a CAGR over that period of time, with, you know, the kind of small dip during COVID. So, I mean, I think the beauty of the business was the stability, which, you know, certainly lenders appreciated. And, you know, basically the multiple that was being asked wasn't really that different if you looked at it in 2020 or 2021 or LTM. You know, it was because the business was so stable. It's like you felt pretty good about your ability to support that regardless over what period you were really
looking. Even if you came in and screw it up.
Yeah. I mean, well, and I think that's the beauty of growth, right? I think growth cures a lot of sins. And so I think for a person in my position coming in, not having run a business before, you know, what you love to see is the fact that this is occurring. And therefore we can maybe take a little bit more risk trying to do some things, seek new customers, make some hires, and, you know, worst case scenario, well, the good news is the market's growing and the business is growing. And so, you know, that'll help kind of cover things. Fortunately, I don't think you know, we haven't made too many mistakes, fortunately, but nonetheless,
42%. Yeah, that cures a lot of sins, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So how did you wrap yourself around landscaping business? Like, you know, some people spend the time in a, you know, private equity or engineering, like myself. So like, I'm going looking for a software company, right? But the multiples are still high. They're coming down and you focus on that. But then there's all of these great, simple, understand cash flow positive, you know, driving by you every day saying, hey, buy me. I mean, how did you wrap yourself around a landscaping business?
Yeah. I mean, I think part of that is like, I never was working with or on or, you know, I never had anything to do with those kind of like high growth, sexy businesses, right? Like I think if I was at, you know, one of the big software investment funds, like I maybe wouldn't, it would be maybe a bigger jump from that to this. But I think the reality is it's like, if you look at the businesses that I had worked at both in banking, when I was doing on the industrials team at Credit Suisse, then at the PE firms, it's like, these were aerospace businesses, niche manufacturing, home services, like things that aren't, you know, far outside of kind of this area. So, I think my kind of comfort level with that, those industries, and frankly, like my attraction to a lot of like the themes of those industries, like stability and fragmentation and M&A opportunity and, you know, et cetera. Like, I think that led me to kind of be eyes wide open to this. Whereas maybe someone, you know, would have initially been like, oh no, I want 30% growth or I'm not interested.
Right. Well, that's good. How was it coming in with the new employees? I had a great interview from a guy in the UK. He came in with the seller and the seller didn't tell anybody about the sale and say, by the way, here's the new owner, and walked out.
it was not like that, fortunately. But I mean, it was, you know, I think in any situation like that, it's very difficult. Especially, you know, when there's longstanding people that are, you know, with the business.
How long's the longest staying employee there?
10 years.
10 years. That's great.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is great and super important, you know, someone that we can rely on, you know, every day. So, I mean, that's great. But yeah, I mean, it's a difficult scenario whenever I think this happens. I think it obviously is exacerbated when you have a guy that has not worked in the industry or, you know, never, you know, run a business or, you know, things like that. Right. And so,
who is this young guy taking over our business? I mean, essentially, what he knows about landscaping. Look, I used to mow my own lawn. I know how to, you know.
Yeah, I mean, essentially. And so for me, it was really just like being very transparent that I'm going to be relying on them. You know, like I have zero intention of like coming in, changing a bunch of stuff day one, you know, because I don't know anything. And so I tried to really spend the first 4 to 6 months just learning, asking questions. Sometimes I would write down questions and not necessarily ask them, wait until I could try to figure out if I could learn the answer myself, you know, and maybe I'll figure out the reason we do something as opposed to just like asking it and maybe
sounding stupid
commotion. Yeah. Not just that, but because I don't necessarily care if I sound dumb, but for me, I just didn't want to like concern people that I was, you know, investigating and going to change a bunch of things. And so I would just kind of, oh, you know, this is something I want to look into.
Yeah.
And then 2 weeks later, I might find out like, oh, by the way, that's why we do that. Okay. Never mind. Cross that off, you know? And so by the time we had, you know, a more kind of full team discussion after say 6 months, I think I was much more informed on a lot of the topics. And so the things that I still wanted to, you know, talk about and ask questions on and stuff were, I think, much better questions and more relevant to the business, frankly. And I think it led to, you know, a good discussion.
Yeah. Did anybody leave because of your new management or style?
Nope.
No. Congratulations.
I mean, we've obviously had, you know, there's obviously been turnover at the crew level. I mean, maybe some of it is related to me. I would say probably not. I think it's just a pretty fluid.
Yeah. It's not like you're going to be go drinking beers with your employees now.
Yeah. Right. And so, yeah, no major issues there, which is obviously very fortunate. And certainly, I mean, that's an area, you know, we were talking before about kind of diligence issues. I mean, to me, that's one of the biggest one risks, right? And it's a really tough one to diligence because in these SMBs, like, I mean,
did anything pop up? You looked under the hood and it, no, we didn't talk about, and it was just a big red flag.
I mean, well, I'll give you one small example, but what I was just going to say is like, I think in these SMBs very infrequently, if ever does the owner want you kind of full, like open kimono with the team in prior to close, right? Because of the risk of like, well, what if it doesn't work out, you know? And then he's just alerted everyone.
Scared everybody into crap because the first thing they do is come out and goes, I'm going to get fired.
Right. Totally. Yeah. And so this was no different than that. And so I didn't have that access prior to close. And so you really are, I mean, that's a massive risk obviously that you're taking, and you're putting a lot of faith in what the owner, the seller is telling you, that, you know, the team is what they say they are and that they'll stick around and all of that stuff. So, you know, that's obviously a huge risk, but I got very fortunate there that it turned out to be true.
Lovely.
Yeah. I think, you know, to answer your other question though, I mean, you know, there's a lot of things that during diligence, I maybe thought one thing and then it turned out to be something a little bit different.
But that's not something he tried to.
No, there was nothing that he was disingenuous. Right? Yeah. I wouldn't say that there was anything that he was disingenuous on or anything like that. I mean, the only thing at all, and again, I don't really wouldn't classify this as disingenuous. It's just, I think his role in the way he described some of his duties was slightly, like, I think he was more involved than he probably let on at times. And I think, I don't know that he did this maliciously at all. I think it was more just like, oh yeah, like, I guess I am kind of important for that, you know, that too, you know what I mean? Where like, maybe he didn't see himself in some of those ways. Yeah. And so I think I kind of uncovered pretty quickly, like, oh, you know, he's actually pretty important in this capacity. And yeah, he does do a little bit of work in this capacity. So it was really just like, you know, filling some of those things.
Yeah.
Which again is,
let me ask you about this. Like, there's a stat out there that about 90% of people that start looking for a business actually don't purchase one. They make too many obstacles in their way. Was there anything that you made bigger than it was and almost like an obstacle? And now that it's realized, you're like, I shouldn't have made that so big.
That's a good question. I would say no. I think, as I kind of mentioned with the whole valuation point, I think after I went through that first experience, I kind of told myself like, I'm not going to do that. Like I'm going to accept a little bit more risk if I have to, and I'm going to, you know, as long as within reason, I'm going to probably just kind of go in at the ask on for evaluation and not try to, you know, basically be, like I said, be cute with, you know, pro forma-ing different things.
Not a PE.
Yeah. I think honestly, I mean, yeah. In some ways I would probably say like the opposite. Like, I think that there are, in hindsight, I think there probably were a couple of things that, like, looking back on it, I'm like, I probably should have, honestly, like, it worked out, thank goodness, but I probably should have made a bigger deal about this, or should have pushed harder on that, or should have really, you know, really got, you know, someone to do an inspection of all assets. That's something that, you know, whenever people ask me, like, what is something you do differently? I would have done that. I would have gotten an independent mechanic to come in and inspect everything.
But what would that have done if you spent money doing that? You looked at each lawnmower, each blower, each like hedge trimmer, whatever it is, like, well, you know, it's 3 years old. Well,
I think on balance, if you do that and you do a couple other things and the net of those is all kind of in one direction, you give yourself a little bit of kind of leverage to say, listen, I want to do this. I want to close. I'm trying to be reasonable here, but then my guy just looked at all the equipment, right? You're saying there's whatever number of trucks and, you know, whatever you think the value is. My guy's saying that like two of them aren't working. This one's going to stop working. And the value really is this. Like, I think that you give yourself a little, you give yourself some room to say, like, I think we need to adjust purchase price for, you know, the risk that day one, like, I need to go buy two new trucks basically, or something, you know, something to that effect.
Sure. And those are $35,000.
Yeah. And like I said, maybe you don't do it just over that, but if you, you know, the assets is one example, you know, speaking with customers, like that, again, something that worked out really well for me, but like could have gone the other direction, and, you know, something that people don't want to give you exposure to pre-close, right? Because of the same risk we were talking about before. And so, you know, that's another one. And it's like, if, depending on how that discussion goes, maybe you speak to a couple key customers and they say, well, I'll give you a chance, but like, I'm not going to guarantee that I'm going to re-sign with you or something, you know, once the deal goes through. Again, if you have a few of these things that are kind of on the margins and really presenting themselves as risk after spending a bit more time on them, like, I think that may give you kind of the, you know, ammunition to push back on some valuation points. But again, I took the approach of like, he's being reasonable. I'm trying to be reasonable. This seems fair.
So he wanted out. He was a motivated seller. He's like, yeah.
Yeah. And honestly, he's just a reasonable guy too. Like, I think he's smart and he understands like what he was asking for was fair and it wasn't crazy. And so someone's going to be willing to do that.
Do you think landscaping business, I interviewed another guy in California that owns three landscaping businesses doing a roll up there, or an accumulator or a serial acquirer. Anyway, he loves the business because it's reoccurring revenue.
Yeah.
But it's a low multiple, easy to understand. I mean, what did you love about this business that said, like, I like it, I'm going to go for it, I love the cash flow, reoccurring?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I think the thing that, I think my answer to that is probably slightly different. And that's somewhat because of the makeup of the business for us at Close. Now it's shifted a lot, and a lot of our growth has been in the recurring side, which was my kind of goal to begin with, but that was not the focus, you know, initially. I think my answer to that though would be, I really liked that it is in business where effort is truly correlated with results. And so I think, as an example, you know, I had looked at one point at like a niche manufacturing business. They made cardboard boxes for munitions and Department of Defense and things like that. And it was like incredibly well insulated from like downturns, right? You're, you know, in a recession, like, I don't see what's going on with this business. Like, you know, they have great contracts, you know, all this stuff. I have zero idea how you could grow that. You could send 15,000 emails to people, you know, talking about how great you are and all your
strong. You're not going to get one more Defense Department contract.
You're right. So unless you're going to create a new product and, you know, do work for Amazon, or I have no idea. Like, it's just, I don't think you could put all the effort in, and I'm not sure that you would get any results. This isn't the opposite. I mean, this is truly like to the point where like I, you know, kind of have rough idea of averages at this point, where it's like, if I send 1,000 emails, right, using some automated outreach system, which I've kind of devised a whole kind of plan around basically. But if I send 1,000 emails, I know that I get, you know, X percent responses, which are asking for proposal opportunities. From there, our close rate is Y, and therefore 1,000 emails equals blank amount of, you know, new customers. Right. And it's proven pretty true over the course of the year. And so it's like, if I wanted to right now, I could sit here and spend 3 hours and pull up a bunch of more emails and send this mass outreach and probably get some more proposal opportunities. And to me, as someone in my position, you know, new industry, new business owner, all these things, like having that kind of safety net is massive, because we were talking before about like curing sins. I mean, you know, knowing that I could maybe make some wrong decisions, but like, if I spend a lot of effort on this, I can help us get growth. That's a really, really reassuring thing, I think, as a individual in my position. And so, that's been huge. And in some of the times where, you know, I've been the most stressed about different things, like being able to rely on that and just get back to the kind of the grindstone of like reaching out to people, building this pipeline, meeting with people, getting new, you know, business. It's like, it makes you feel better. You're like, all right, well, I'll be able to get through some of these other challenges, 'cause I know like we still have this pipeline going.
Yeah. Adrian, lovely. I want to thank you so much for being on our podcast.
Yeah, I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for having me.
Good luck with the business. Good luck with your future acquisitions too.
Thank you. Hopefully it works out.
Yeah. Take care.
All right. Have a good one.
All right, bye. I hope this video has inspired you. If you need help buying your first $1 million business, make sure to visit me at dealflowsystem.net. If you like this video, make sure you subscribe down below. Comment on it, share it, tell everyone about it. And thanks for watching.